This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Welcome back to A Complete History of Manchester United. I'm Wayne Barton, author and producer of several Manchester United books and films, joined as always by Paddy Barclay, the legendary football writer and retired journalist, author of the definitive biography of Sir Matt Busby, a biography of Alex Ferguson, Sir Alex Ferguson, of course, got to sir them both up, and obviously a biography of Jose Mourinho as well, so as well versed as any man can be in the Manchester United managerial lineage. And we are taking you on this journey through Old Trafford history. If you're watching the video, please give us a like and subscribe and join in the conversation in the comment section. If you're listening back on the audio podcast, please be sure to subscribe and give us a review on the platform you're listening on. Manchester United last time promoted from the second division. We were very, very lucky, Paddy, to have the accompaniment of Sammy McElroy, who took us through that journey back into the top flight. It was a great experience talking to him. The stories he was telling us about how in the post-season, United went to Australia, which seems absolutely crazy that they did so, but that's what they did for the entire summer. They went away to Australia, and you would have thought a team who were... they had such reserves of energy, and their entire game plan was based around this energy. It seemed like the worst possible thing that they could have done, really, in terms of keeping that momentum going for their following season. But back in the top flight, that team who took the second division by storm was perfectly placed to compete at the top of the division already. And that was without Willie Morgan had been transferred out and Steve Coppell was now a permanent fixture on the right. How surprising was it that United were that good straight away? Because they were immediately competing at the top.
Yeah, well, it would have been extraordinary today. I mean, in terms of teams coming up, yeah, there were others that later did that, Nottingham Forest being the obvious example, going all the way to the title. But Ipswich had done it before. But really, I don't think there was a great deal of surprise because United had been so good in the second division. They'd really just burned through it. And playing such confident football, there was still concern. And if you look at the team now, maybe nowadays it would have found it difficult to compete in height and a lot of these physical attributes. But the football was so effervescent that they just walked into the first division, the elite, the Premier League, as it would now be called, as if they owned it. And it was a very, very exciting period because the Busby era, the excitement of the Busby era had been recreated under Tommy Docherty. And the crowd figures, which we'll no doubt discuss at some stage in this episode, very much reflected that. Right from the start, it was pretty close to the 60,000 capacity of the, just over 60,000 capacity of the ground. So, they were so effervescent and exciting that even though I think Gordon Hill was not signed until 3 months into the season, that number 11 shirt, which had been problematic ever since Ian Storey-Moore, a wonderful signing under Well, Busby actually made the signing, but it was under the management of Frank O'Farrell, a player who would have been a United legend but for injury. Gordon Hill at last filled that number 11 jersey, the outside left jersey, and United had balance. It had the old Busby tradition of two proper wingers, which had been there right from the post-war start of the Busby era with Mitten and the Scotsman. I've forgotten his name. The outside right.
Delaney.
Delaney and Mitten. You know, that right from the start of the Busby era, two wingers. And now, with the signing of Gordon Hill 3 months into this season, we have Coppell on one wing, Hill on the other, different kinds of players, but both scored goals. And they had this balance. It really looked like a Manchester United team. And you expect a Manchester United team to compete for all the trophies. And this one didn't disappoint.
Yeah, it was interesting. Obviously, the dynamic of this team, we'll talk about the complete evolution of it in the following episode. But yes, it was interesting to know how really that front six, it was McCrory and McIlroy who had blossomed into real stalwart figures around which the attack was built. Their confidence had built and grown over the sort of 2 years they've been around the side. Obviously, they've been in there as young players and they both had their issues. McIlroy with the car crash and the subsequent recovery and the confidence kind of assumed the responsibility, the creative responsibility. McCrory coming in with a massive price tag over his head and not really being a 30-goal season striker, which everyone was hoping for. But that now they were both growing in confidence and they were the staples in that team. Mm. Funnily enough, McIlroy at the start of the season is playing from the left again. And you've got McCrory playing in the front. Over time, both would move into the middle of the park and become the heartbeat of the side. But it shows their importance in sort of bringing United back into the top flight and how critical they were in terms of the leading the attack really for United's attacking play and the style. They were every modern interview that you take with any player from this squad, and I'm sure you found the same, Paddy, they'll liken Doherty's team from this period to Barcelona of the modern era. In terms of, they would say Doherty said they were like flies around a sugar bowl.
Yeah.
And it's important to make a distinction when we're having this conversation, because people will think, oh, total football in the 70s that wasn't played by Holland. That's not necessarily what they're talking about, because ball possession wasn't really a thing. Apart from the defence, the really defensive teams would look to keep hold of the ball. This wasn't what Manchester United were doing. It was about ball recovery and pressing the ball high up the pitch. That's what they mean when they're talking about the Barcelona style of football, the way that they would harass teams and push them higher up the pitch.
Yeah, that's true. And I would say there's one other similarity. When you look at many of the great Barcelona teams, you see that the centre-backs are both footballers.
Yeah,
I remember sort of Rijkaard and Koeman, you know, guys who could have played central midfield, you know, easily. In fact, did. Ditto, Martin Buchan and Brian Greenough, both of whom could have played midfield and in Greenough's case did. So, and I think Buchan might have played a couple of games in midfield as well, but he certainly would have been capable of doing so. So that's another incidental similarity, even though Doherty may not have designed it that way. But when your football really does flow from the back, when you have two footballers like Martin Buchan and Brian Greenough as your centre-backs.
Yeah, they were stoppers and sweepers, basically, and every team would have one stopper. The sweeper would be, it was a kind of like a modern invention. He was the player who would bring the ball out. You could have two stoppers in many of these two-man central defences, but you wouldn't often, you wouldn't get two sweepers, which was what made this so revolutionary. And you mentioned Brian bringing the ball out from the back. It actually plays a part. We'll come into later in the season, one of the most famous goals scored under the Doherty era. United started the season really well. They won the first, won five of the first six games. They did play with that ambition, the flair, exactly the same kind of imposing style they'd played in the second division. They just carried on playing the same way and they didn't show any signs of fatigue from going down under. Occasionally, though, the the naivety of that attacking play did cost them in the early parts of the season as they started coming up against top quality opposition. People were surprised when their first defeat was a QPR, but really looking at what QPR were doing with this great side, it wasn't so much of a surprise, really, in retrospect.
No, they. I mean, I don't want to spoil the ending, but QPR went within a point of the league title that year. They were an outstanding team. I remember them, how they played football on the mud heap that was Loftus Road. In the pre-AstroTurf days, I don't quite know, but it was a very good side, and they didn't change it much. It was the team of Don Masson, I think, and David Thomas on the wing, and the manager was Gordon Jago, and I think I honestly can't think that they used more than 14 or 15 players during the season. They were very good, so there was no disgrace in losing to QPR, especially at QPR.
Yeah, they also lost Derby, who were a great side. West Ham, who were challenging for European honours at this time. Yeah. Liverpool and Arsenal. So these were their defeats in the early season. But it just shows, first of all, that United were a very young side now, thanks to the turnover of all the players. And also, they did have that naivety that came with being a young side, going back into the top flight against teams who were experienced winners and experienced for challenging for honours. But like you mentioned earlier, Gordon Hill signs in November.
Yeah.
Very critical signing in terms of the balance of this team, because it finally gave like a very distinct right and left side and a very distinct middle core of this team, didn't it?
Yes.
And Gordon, I mean, he came from Millwall, had just been relegated to the third division at the start of this season. So he's making a leap of two divisions. Obviously, well, I'm going to be very biased towards Gordon because I know him very well, but... let's give him a little bit of a tribute here, because the way that he settled into life in the top flight was quite remarkable, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. He came from next to nothing. I actually, if you don't mind, I'll just take a slight detour here to pay tribute. And in fact, I know you won't mind, because the point is to make a tribute to Jimmy Murphy, who'd been brought out of mothballs by Doherty. And my word, that was probably one of Doherty's smartest ever moves, because the previous year he discovered Steve Coppell at Tranmere, and he went to Doherty and he said, "Buy Gordon Hill." And Doherty was quite open about it. He said, "If Jimmy Murphy says buy a player, I don't need any more information, I buy him." And he got Gordon Hill. He got the two of them for about 120,000 quid, which is amazing business, because they were fantastic players, different sort of players. We think of that team, this team, as 4-2-4, probably. I don't know how we'll come to your tactics board at the end, and I'd be interested to see how you lay it out. But Coppell always insisted. He hated being called a winger. He said, "I'm a right-sided midfield player," but he sure as hell had all the attributes of a winger. Gordon Hill had all of those, plus a goal-scoring ratio that a lot of strikers would have killed for. And I'm sure you won't let this episode go without mention of one particular goal that he scored. He was a thrilling player, probably a more thrilling player than Steve Coppell. Not necessarily a better one, but more thrilling. And he became a crowd favourite immediately, because he played in you know him far better than I ever did, but he's got a boyish person. I don't know if he still has a boyish personality. And he played. He had that childlike quality when he played. He skipped and he beat people for fun. He did a lot of things for fun. There was fun in his. He played with a smile on his face, and so it, of course, immediately became a crowd favorite.
Yeah, the king of all Cockneys, not necessarily a natural successor to the King Dennis Lowe, but certainly the king of all Cockneys. And yeah, Old Trafford took to him straight away, and they called him the happiest Londoner who ever went north or something like that. and he was brilliant. And any sort of look back at the goals that he scored, you can see they were just a spectacular variety. His style of volleying was, no one matched that until Mark Hughes came up.
Absolutely, yes. A great shout. If you were to compile a list of the best volleys of, you know, of the last 50 years or something, he would come into the equation, as would Mark Hughes. So he had that, and you know, just the he could beat people. He had tricks galore, and most important from the team's point of view, he was chipping in with goals. They had strikers. You know, you said Mercari wasn't prolific. It's true. He quite selfless player, Lou Mercari, considering he'd been such a big star at Celtic a few years earlier. He fitted into very much a team player at Old Trafford. And then there was Stuart Pearson, also a popular player with his teammates for the effort he put in for the team, but definitely a goal-scoring striker. But what made this team so good was the contribution of other players, Sammy McIlroy being one example in terms of goal scoring. When other players are chipping in with six or seven, my goodness, doesn't half make a difference and take the pressure off the strikers. Gordon Hill as well.
Yeah, I mean, I had sort of bumpy start. Well, not start, but bumpy autumn basically ruled them out of the first division title race. But they still, with Hill in the side, they basically recovered. The form was really good over the sort of like winter to spring, and they were sort of in touching distance. And we'll get to what how close that touching distance was, but they were there or thereabouts. They were competing at the top. The style was fantastic. Hill providing that balance on the left, Koppel extraordinarily consistent on the right. Both of them handling that step up in quality, and becoming two of the standout wingers in the league, really, in the way that United taking the league by storm. The philosophy seems sound. United they went on a cup run that began to capture the imagination of the city, especially after an epic tie with Wolves in the quarterfinal, which United won in extra time. That set up a semi-final with Derby County. And Derby were one of the top sides, so this was a real test to see how far United had come. And it was played at Hillsborough. I'm sure Gordon, again, if he's going to be watching this, and he may well, because I'll tell him that we're putting on quite a tribute to him.
Good.
Gordon's overall goal-scoring tally for United, and you mentioned it earlier, but his overall ratio was actually pretty much like-for-like with Ronaldo's. In terms of goals per game, which tells you, and we're talking about a player who did only play down the left. You mentioned Koppel, his view of his position was as a right-sided midfielder. It's basically because Hill had license to do what he wanted, and if Hill basically joined in as a 4-3-3, as a three-man attack, then Koppel would make it narrower to make a 4-3-3. They were quite flexible, even though, to all intents and purposes, anyone that you would talk to would always say this team's 4-2-4. They did have the ability to either go compact as a 4-4-2 or could play as a 4-3-3, with Hill being the more cavalier and Koppel having more responsibility. It was a perfect blend. And again,
sorry to interrupt, but just on this point, I'd be interested to know whether you think part of what made that side so well balanced was that, yes, Koppel a little bit better at the defensive arts than Hill, had behind him Alex Forsyth, who, correct me if I'm wrong, was Alex Forsyth not better going forward than defending?
Yeah.
Whereas Stuart Houston on the other side, behind Hill, although he could come forward, was a superb defender, a centre-back, you know, converted to a left-back, and that sort of, did that not help the balance of the side in that there was a bit more protection for Forsyth than for Houston, who didn't need the protection as much?
Absolutely. And you've got to say as well, Houston being that more defensive, resolute player also helped Greenough come forward with the ball. It provided a backbone there as well. So Doherty, he often refers to the repositioning as, or he referred when he was alive to repositioning as Brian in the centre-half position, as an accident, something that was a happy stroke of fortune. But it was really a stroke of genius in the way that it helped this side set up in terms of the way, the very core principle of the way that they played. And this was very prominent in the game against Derby County. The other thing that should be mentioned about, we're talking about Koppel and Hill in particular, but Hill was the first time that United had had a standout extrovert in the side since George Best, in the manner that, and we're not, I'm not going to compare him to George Best or Duncan Edwards, but at their best, United had always been a team that played a specific style of football, a specific, specific way, and they accommodated one standout individual. That front six of Doherty basically all played with industry, apart from Hill, who was the cavalier standout maverick in that side, which made it kind of like it was a reminiscent and a nostalgic side for this United fan base who were getting behind. Obviously, a lot of these United fans had grown up in the post 68 era, you know, they'd start to travel to games and everything like that, so they wanted a hero, and Hill fell into that. And so, the game against Derby at Hillsborough, it was such a massive event. United fans travelled in hordes, obviously. It was more like a home game. And then midway through the first half, Brian brings the ball out from the back, plays the ball to Jerry Daly. Daly has a look around. Gordon's popped up on the right wing, plays the ball to Gordon. Gordon cuts in, hits an absolute belter of a shot into the top corner. And the crowd go absolutely crazy because it's looking like United are going to go back to Wembley. And Gordon adds a second goal in the second half, a deflected free kick, but a bit of a an error for the defender to get in the way of it, really, because it was hit with such power. So, I mean, talk us through the atmosphere of that day, because, I mean, United fans had, obviously, they were gaining kind of a notorious reputation anyway, particularly in the early part of the 70s. We've talked about the occasions in which the home games had to be moved and everything like that. The Red Army had been definitely infamous in the way that they travelled in the second division. But it was certainly an incredible atmosphere that day, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. You know, it was one of the sort of the old saws, the old cliches about football. Nobody remembers the semi-finals. And this probably stood out because it was so open and cavalier in the way. It was a sort of Gordon Hill kind of match. And so fitting that he was the main personality, as you say. Great atmosphere at Hillsborough, and you know, an atmosphere to which the United contingent contributed. I mean, it's actually just dawning on us as we go through this chronologically that Manchester United is becoming bigger in terms of population than at most times under Busby. Okay, the ground was bigger. Manchester United's crowd, we'll get onto the crowd later, but the average was 51,000. We'll get on later, I'm sure, to the significance of that figure vis-a-vis the rest of football. Because during the entirety of Busby's reign as manager, Manchester United were not different in terms of, yes, the Busby Babes was the best team in the country, became it, but they weren't different in terms of finance. They weren't always, for a lot of time on Busby, during Busby, they weren't the most watched team in the country. By now, Manchester United were on a different level support-wise, both home and away, to any other club in England. And that, as I say, was an advantage that Doherty and his successors were to enjoy, that Busby never really did to the same extent.
Yeah, it is funny the way that you talk about that, because anyone who really, really gets into the meat and bones of United's history will know that even before Busby came along, before this podcast, basically. I'm sure that maybe in time we'll go back and look at that era, but United was still seen as one of the most romantic clubs in the country, mostly because they'd faced financial ruin twice. Their first great team after they'd become known as Manchester United, where they had superstars from Manchester City who sort of defected across town, sort of Billy Meredith. So when they won the first title in 1908, they were seen as a great footballing side, one of the great first footballing sides in English football history. In fact, I'm pretty sure I'm not that old, and Paddy isn't as well. So I should make that note. But the reports at the time were that United basically were the most glamorous. They were most glamorous first division side that had ever won the title. So we're now advancing to a time where obviously you've got Munich, you've got the relegation, you've got the romance of the European Cup. It was a storyline club. Really, the way in which they were developing, it was like a real life soap opera, and people were intrigued by that. And there is no doubt in obviously there was a human affection for what happened after Munich, but there was also a curiosity of the romance of coming back, the fact that they went down, the fact that Dennis Lord scored a back heel to send them, well, symbolically send them down. All of these things did add to the theatre, as Bobby Charlton would later call it. So this intrigue that United were, you know, in fight back, you know, and the fact that, you know, now you had a generation of, like I said earlier, a generation of supporters were following the fathers who watched the Busby Babes. They watched United going to the European Cup, but now they were able to travel themselves and see that there's a really feverish connection to this team at United, and the youthfulness, I think, added to it as well. The youthfulness of the team and the youthfulness of the support, it was like they were growing up together, and that's always a great combination for an atmosphere. United, though, because again, that naivety comes in, the distraction of this cup run, the idea that they get into Wembley and they're going to be able to play against Southampton in the final, which they would.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Picture the scene. All of your mates around, you've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Partner this with your team playing champagne football. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. There's nothing quite like a McDelivery. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Heavily tipped as favourites, even despite that inexperience, because Southampton were in the second division. The following week after the semi-final, they lose 3-0 at Ipswich. Any slim hope of really challenging for the league title is dashed when they lose 1-0 at home to Stoke, a game in which Peter Shilton, who Doherty has tried to sign earlier in the season to replace Alex Stepney. Shilton is absolutely tremendous as well. I should also mention, around this time, two of those defeats against Liverpool and Arsenal, and I think United's exit from the League Cup, a lot of people blame the displacement of Alex Stepney for that, because in that period of time, Doherty put in Paddy Roach. This was around the time he made these attempts to sign Peter Shilton. It'd been rebuffed because Busby was putting his foot down and saying there's no way that we're going to pay, I think, was it £1,000 a week or 100? It was something for it. It was basically, it would have made the goalkeeper the highest paid player at the club. Which Busby said that he wouldn't stand for. And I found that so curious, because everything you know about Busby is he broke the bank 3 times to set a world record for goalkeepers.
You know, he did, that's right, yeah. He did, Ray Wood and Harry Gregg,
Stepney as well.
And Stepney.
Reg Allen was the other one.
Not Ray Wood, Reg Allen, you're quite right, from QPR,
He'd done that. Obviously, he didn't sign those goalkeepers, Doherty, but he put Paddy Roach in, and Roach had nowhere near the experience of Stepney. And those two defeats to Liverpool and Arsenal would end up, I mean, Roach has got a lot of blame for that, but they would prove quite crucial in the direction of the league title at the back end of the season. So United couldn't score against Shilton. It was a one-man brick wall. United lose 1-0 at home to Stoke, and that's not really great preparation for the cup final. Southampton had loads of experience. They had Jim McAlliog, who we've talked about previously in the series. He'd moved to Southampton at this point. Talk us through the 1976 FA Cup final. United really unable to rouse themselves on the day, Paddy.
Yes, it was a you know, the usual sort of slow, slightly laboured FA Cup final. Southampton, as you rightly say, were full of not only experience but class. Yeah. I'm just looking at the team now. It had Mick Shannon, Peter Osgood, Jim McAleogue, who'd had a good spell at United before then. Yeah. Jim Steele, slow but physical defender. Mel Blythe, who wasn't bad. Nick Holmes, who would run all day. And at right back, Peter Rodrigues, the Wales right back, a very decent right full back too. So it wasn't a bad side. But United, yes, rightly still favourites. Southampton were in the second division. I don't know where they did they get promoted that year under Laurie McMenemy. I'm just not sure. But anyway, a very good side under a very good manager. But United just didn't step up. It was the usual team: Stepney, Forsyth, Houston, Jerry Daly, Brian Greenough, Martin Buchan, Steve Coppell, Sammy McElroy, Stuart Pearson, Lou Macari, and Gordon Hill, with David McCreary, a good chance to mention him, on the bench. He made 16 league appearances on the bench during the season and 12 starts. So David McCreary was very much a useful piece of cement in that side. Anyway, it didn't go well. The now, sadly, late Bobby Stokes scored the goal with a low drive from about, 20 yards, something like that. Stepney couldn't stop it. And that was it. Stepney's been around for a while now, hasn't he, in this series? How often do we think, God, is he still there? But Stepney, yeah, still United's number one goalkeeper. But sadly, from the United point of view, to receive a runners-up medal at the end of that game. Of course, for the country as a whole, you talked before about the popularity of United, but equally there was beginning to, partly because the fans were not popular and partly because they were doing so well, there was definitely the old Schadenfreude from on behalf of the country, delighted that the underdogs won, as indeed with Leeds Sunderland before that. So United don't win the FA Cup. They'd been knocked out of the League Cup. They had about three games in the League Cup, I think. But they're knocked out by Manchester City, in the League Cup. So the cups are now gone. Interesting to find out from you, Wayne, did they win the league?
No, they didn't. After losing to Stoke, they went and lost Leicester City, which basically put the nail in that coffin. It did recover from the that was a penultimate league game, but the FA Cup final was played before the last league game. Yeah. So they did at least, when they came back to Manchester, they actually had a parade anyway, even though they didn't win. And at the town hall, Tommy Docherty embraced all the fans. He said, next year we'll bring the cup back to the finest fans in all the land, which even the players thought was a bit bullish. And they weren't quite so confident as Tommy Docherty, but, he was a man to make outlandish promises for sure. At least United gave the fans something to cheer in the last home game. Hill and McElroy scoring in a 2-0 win over Manchester City. That secured third place. You mentioned Derby, QPR, finishing second place, 1 point behind Liverpool. So United were third, 4 points behind Liverpool. So those two games which Paddy Roach basically featured in against Arsenal and Liverpool did prove decisive, as decisive as the 1-0 defeat at Stoke. Another thing to mention on the Wembley game, because United's style of football was so dominantly forced now around these wingers, it's not the old Wembley pitch was definitely not one for wingers. It was one for industry in the middle of the park. That's where the games would generally be won. It'd be they used to call it a graveyard for wingers at one point, especially when the teams were playing the old 4-4-2 shapes, because it was such a big pitch. The games were usually in May. They'd been, especially that year, was the record breaking heat year, so it would have been in a very hot Wembley.
It was very sultry. That was a contributory factor to the pace of the game. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah, Southampton, though, worthy winners, using all that experience. Liverpool, worthy winners, as unfortunately, my prediction in the earlier series that they would follow United and go down to the second division didn't quite turn out. They've handled their post, the post-Shankly succession, they've handled it a little bit better than what United did with Busby. And they are champions, even though United did score two more goals than them, so they win one moral fight.
Yeah.
But third place in the top flight, an FA Cup final, that's a really good first.
It's a phenomenal first season back. I mean, can you imagine now if a team came up from the Championship to the Premier League and at Easter had at least a theoretical chance of the double, which this United team did. So, I mean, it was a tremendous return to the top by most standards. And just, you know, you mentioned Liverpool won the league, but just to reinforce the point I made earlier about United's support growing and growing and growing, the United's average crowd was 54,000. Liverpool won the league with an average crowd of 41,000. Yeah. So that's 25% less. So that kind of emphasizes just how big Manchester United were becoming.
Yeah, we'll go through the squad stats very quickly before we come on to the rest of football. I'll pop up this gent on the screen first, but I'll go through the goalkeepers first of all. Alex Stepney was the main goalkeeper, as we've already established. 47 appearances, 38 in the league. And Paddy Roach made 5 appearances, 4 of those fateful in the league, really. Arthur Alveston, after making his breakthrough in the previous season, makes just 3 appearances this season, all in the league. Martin Buchan, ever-present. He plays 52 games in all competitions, 42 in the league, obviously, without scoring a single goal. Alex Forsyth, 3 goals in 35 games, 2 in 28 in the league. Brian Greenough, 1 goal in 50 games, no goals in 40 league appearances. Stuart Houston with 2 goals in 52, and he played every single league game, and they were where his goals were as well. Jimmy Nicol made 25 appearances in all competitions, 20 of those in the league. And Tony Young, who'd been around the squad and made plenty of appearances, just makes 1 single substitute appearance this season. Brings us on to Tony Grimshaw there, fullback. He makes just 2 substitute appearances. These are the only ones that he makes for the club. He's Manchester-born teenager who played at fullback. And, they were the only appearances they made. One of those was in the league and 1 in the League Cup. Brings us to the midfield. Steve Coppell, 39 appearances in the league, 4 goals, 49 in all competitions and 5 goals. Jerry Daly, 11 goals in 51 in all competitions, 7 in 41 in the league. David McCreevy, you mentioned earlier, 16 substitute appearances in the league and 12 appearances from the start. So that was 4 goals in 32 appearances overall, 19 of those from the bench. So really super sub. I say super sub, but definitely always, pretty much always number 12. And he was a utility man. Probably at his best in holding midfield, but he could play in defence at fullback. He even played in the attack on occasion as well, but really good. Eric Cantona was later quite disparaging about them. It was a really good water carrier, wasn't it, David McCreary? and we'll talk about it in the future as well, for sure. Sammy Mack, 13 goals in 51 appearances, 10 in 41, as he made a great contribution to the return in the top flight. Gordon Hill, his first appearance in the Manchester United history books, ends with 10 goals in 33 appearances, 7 in 26 in the league. Really good start from him. You mentioned he was a winger from Millwall. I'm going to give a little bit of an added history, a little bit of context to the Jimmy Murphy story. So he'd actually come on United's radar when he was actually on loan from Millwall at Chicago Sting. Chicago Sting were coached by Bill Foulkes, and it was he who got the word to Old Trafford and said that he recommended that United take a look at him. You're quite right. Jimmy Murphy went to watch him play. I think Millwall were at Tranmere, and he'd seen enough after 30 minutes. He walked out and just said he's definitely, you know, his left foot is like a dream or something like that. I think that's what he actually said to Jimmy Murphy Jr. He went to the Throstle's Nest to meet Jimmy Murphy Jr. after watching Gordon play. He got home in time for the last bell to get a pint in. Yeah. And he said, I've seen a player tonight. He's a dead cert. And he was still feeling quite marginalised by the club. And Jimmy Murphy Jr. remembered him saying, I don't know why I should bother because the club don't seem to bother about me. Mm. And his son said to him, you will bother because you're a man of too much integrity. And apparently he actually walked straight to the phone box and told Tommy to sign him and not sleep on it, because other clubs were going to go in for him, and they were going in for him. And that advice proved fateful because United signed him. And he was a left winger who played with freedom, played with liberation, and genuinely, on talent alone, could be regarded as one of the club's greatest. But fate and fortune wouldn't work out that way. But an incredible record, as you can see there. As I said earlier, 51 goals, 134 appearances all told. And a goal ratio similar to that of Cristiano Ronaldo, and he never played in the front line as well. He would go there, don't get me wrong, but never played as an actual out-and-out striker. Brings us to the other midfielders. Let me first come to Tommy Jackson. Tommy Jackson, a midfielder, Northern Irish international, who played in the centre of midfield. The hope was he was actually brought in to captain the reserve side and do a job there, but he settled in so well and he showed such great experience. He was almost 30 after all, that they brought him into the first team, basically to add the bite that the other midfielders didn't have. Gerry Daly wasn't a tackler. Sammy McElroy wasn't a tackler. And Tommy Jackson wasn't really like a hard man in midfield, but he did have that bite. He did have that sort of pragmatism, I guess, that the other players didn't have. And it really helped at United for a while. He made 23 appearances throughout the season. His 23 were overall in all competitions, but he made 20 for United this season, 17 of those in the league. The other midfielder, finally, we get to Jimmy Kelly, who he was a Carlisle-born midfielder. He made just one substitute appearance. That was in the win over Wolves in December that was decided by a last-minute Gordon Hill goal. He went on to play, notably, for Chicago Sting and Tulsa Roughnecks. And in the United States, he actually had a more distinctive career in the NASL than he did in England. So he only made this one substitute appearance. In actual fact, not only Gordon, they were, like David McCreary would be one of them as well. Many of these players, not necessarily from the squad, but many players from this era would go over to the NASL at a time when Pelé and Cruyff were playing. So you'll probably hear a lot more about players who went on to play in North America in this period of time. The front line brings us to Stuart Pearson, 14 goals in 49 games, 13 in 39 in the league. Lou Macari, top goal scorer, 15 goals in 45 games in all competitions, 12 and 36 in the league, which means Pearson was the top league goal scorer. And finally, in the front line, Peter Coyne. He played two games in the latter part of the season. He scored in the second, which was that defeat at Leicester, but he never played a game after that. I mean, imagine scoring in your last game for United and you're not given another chance.
Yeah.
Bit unfair for Peter Coyne, but that was his record. 50% goal rate, which pretty sure he dined out a few times, Not a bad
That actually puts him above Cristiano Ronaldo.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned curiosity for the way that I'd have the tight six set up. I did go in a 4-4-2.
Yeah.
It is a 4-2-4, really. You would be tempted to put Copland Hill in the space between Daly, McElroy, McCorry and Pearson, really. You'd put them a little further up. But just for the ease of putting it there, you wouldn't say it was a flat four by any stretch of the imagination. But it was, you would say, the most associated shape with this team is definitely 4-2-4, wasn't it? United's colours this season, red, white, and black socks. The very cool away kit of Admiral was now the kit manufacturer, and the away kit was white, black, and black. The best thing about the shirt was it had four stripes down the left breast, which was down the Under the Crest as well. And it was pretty much universally acclaimed as the coolest United away strip of all time, at a time when fashion was very important to the youth. When is it not? But certainly then. And so the kit was really cool. It's funny because did we mention this with Sammy on the last podcast? He really hated that strip. He did not like it. He thought it wasn't great. I think some of them, if you grew up watching United wearing red and then blue, as they did in the European Cup final, then you probably always want to wear that.
Yes.
Sammy also wore that brilliant yellow kit as well that I love. But he didn't.
I can't understand why you like yellow strips, but there we go. I like the black and the white from what I can remember of it. Yeah. The United review. Looking good. That's a nice one.
Yeah, it is
livelier than usual.
It very is. If you can't see the if you can't see it because you're listening back on the audio, it's basically welcome to Old Trafford at the top, United review on the bottom, and a nice caricature of most of the players in the middle there.
And not a geezer shaking hands with a player as traditional.
They definitely mixed it up in the 70s, as we can tell. Remember the one that had the circles in the different areas of the pitch? So, yeah, very postmodern, some abstract art going on the United review through this period. You mentioned the average attendances. Let's get to them. So, for the second season in a row, which really is quite startling considering they were relegated and only came up from the second division. The attendance at Old Trafford is up 6,000 for the second season consecutively. So it's now 53,276 overall in all competitions. Tell me, Paddy, talk about you. Obviously, it was extraordinary in terms of Liverpool being 12,000 lower, but that's a great home attendance in United's average in terms of the history as well, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It definitely is it the highest average in the history?
I'm not sure if it's the highest. We'll have to clarify that for the next episode.
I think it must be because the ground didn't hold more than 50. Well, yeah, no, and also another thing about this era is that the disparity between the lowest and the highest attendance is, I mean, there were a couple of 40,000, 41,000, but by and large, they were this average of 53,200, whatever it was. It was usually, you know, it didn't vary massively. Whereas in the past, yes, you would get the odd 60,000 crowd, like for the European matches of the Busby Babes. But you would also get some 30,000s, simply because maybe it was the week before Christmas, or maybe there were two games in a week, and the fans couldn't afford to go to both. So you would get these massive fluctuations in the crowd. Whereas this average of 53,200 in all competitions, it didn't vary much. You know, it was usually around that figure at every game. Perhaps a reflection of higher living standards. Who knows? It was the middle of the 70s, an era that we associate with inflation and, rather than prosperity. But anyway, it's Manchester United becoming the dominant force off the field in terms of support that we now think, you know, people would think, oh, well, yes, they are. They're used to having... They're competing in recent years, perhaps not very successfully, with, let's say, Chelsea, whose ground has 30, and therefore average crowd is 34,000 less. That's an extraordinary disparity, which we're talking about 1975-6. It had never been the case in English football, I don't think, before Manchester United started to pull away in the era that we are describing.
Yeah, so it's the third highest, the two that are higher than that, 66-67, only marginally, it's 54-726. Yeah. And then the following season, when United are league champions and going for the European Cup, so obviously there's going to be interest, which was 57-790. But it's comparable with those figures, which is extraordinary. Yeah. And shows the connection that United fans are having with the team.
Yeah.
The key results for United this season, Paddy, you would probably say the first league game where they won 2-0 at Wolves.
Yeah.
And proved that they were able to cope in that top flight. The 3-2 in which they won at Wolves in the cup as well. Mm-hmm. The 2-0 against Derby County in the semi-final, which obviously very distinctive result when people look at how Tommy Docherty's side play. That's a game that often becomes the go-to reference. And losing the games to Stoke and losing the game to Southampton in the cup final as well. Elsewhere in football, we already mentioned that Liverpool won the league. Manchester City won the League Cup, so in modern times that would be very miserable indeed. Well, in modern times, we live through it. We live through it. Anyone familiar, if they're watching this podcast in 2022, you know that not much changes. Liverpool won the UEFA Cup as well, and West Ham got to the Cup Winners' Cup final and lost that. But it's very, again, another indication that British football was really entering a golden age.
Since you mentioned Europe, of course, Manchester United, by finishing third this season, qualify for Europe, don't they?
Yeah, the UEFA Cup they would be in next season. And interesting, the teams that they would face in that run, as we'll get on to when we do come to that, are some of the biggest. I mean, they couldn't have drawn any harder names, and the names didn't come out of the hat. But a great experience.
I look forward to that in the next episode. Excellent.
Yeah. So that's United 75-76 season. They're back in the top flight. Finished third. Tommy Docherty has really made good on his promise to get United back into the top flight. And more than that, they play with a verve and a style, a flamboyance. They're always on the front foot. It's the United side who are so you would call it naive, really. They're so reluctant to acknowledge the quality of the opposition that Tommy Kavanagh comes into the dressing room and scrunches up the team sheet and throws it into the bin. The message being that, you know, we concentrate on ourselves. But that's what everyone loved about this United side, naivety and all. And the idea was, obviously, with the youthfulness in the side, that they would progress and mature and learn from the mistakes that they've made. Hopefully, Tommy Docherty as well, in not changing the goalkeeper as rash as he did. And that should hopefully increase for more stability as United look to challenge for the league and trophies in the following season. If you are watching this video, please give us a like and subscribe. If you're listening back on the audio podcast, please be sure to subscribe and give us a review on the platform you're listening on. Join in the conversation on the YouTube comment section as well. Thanks for listening, guys, and we will be back very soon to discuss that 76-77 season.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.